Over the past few years, borrowing money via the carry trade has seemed risk-free. But recently, central bankers have been warning that if the yen or the Swiss franc rise, prices can move against investors rapidly and even destabilize the global financial system. Max Kaiser investigates in Iceland.
Iceland's been buying a lot of Britain's high street recently. How does a country with less than 300,000 population, who's got a GDP of $13 billion, less than one-tenth the size of Google, end up buying hundreds of billions of dollars worth of valuable properties here in London and Britain, including the West Ham Football Club?
I believe this financial miracle comes from cheap credit, a fancy word for debt. Never in history has the entire world been so awash in debt. And all this debt begins, many say, with something called the carry trade. This carry trade usually begins in the currency markets, otherwise known as the Forex markets, the biggest market in the world where $3 trillion worth of trades happen every single day. I'll show you how the carry trade is done. First, I need to borrow some money from a country with low interest rates.
Let's flip this coin to decide. Heads, Tokyo. Tails, Zurich. Tails, Zurich. Whoa! A little bit too much on that one. The Forex market can be a very dangerous place. You never know, day to day, what kind of trades you might encounter, what kind of danger might be out there. Zurich, of course, one of the most dangerous towns in the world, if you're not lucky. Now, fortunately, I should have some Swiss francs in my pocket. Exactly. Here's something I can do. With these Swiss francs, I can actually perform a little bit of Forex legerdemain. By taking these Swiss francs, then by jumping back into the Forex market and coming out in another town, I'll show you how we can make some money. Wow, so the currency in Zurich has been magically transformed into the local currency here in Iceland, the Icelandic krona, and I immediately pick up 5, 6, 7% of my money. I didn't get this money by manufacturing or producing or savings. I just got it from interest rate speculating, interest rate arbitrage. Economics appears to have gone through a radical transformation where the king is the speculator and the chump who's caught working for a living in a factory is considered yesterday's news.
Today's news is debt. More and more consumers, corporations, investors, and speculators are taking on more and more debt, thanks to low global interest rates. Glenn Stevens, governor of Australia's Reserve Bank, said of Japan's near 0% interest rate policy, quote, "There is something very strange about a G3 country giving out free money. This has an effect on global markets. It is by no means clear that it is a healthy state of affairs to persist."
Dr. Paul Walker, CEO, GFMS Limited.
The governor's probably on the money there, that when you have a situation where the Japanese are effectively giving away their cash, you can borrow it for free, for all intents and purposes, or maybe a few basis points, that does have global implications and necessarily would hold the global interest rate environment lower than it otherwise would be.
So all this borrowed money doesn't always end up in the currency. A lot of it goes into real estate, it goes into art. A lot of it goes into fueling mergers and acquisitions, which is part of another piece of the global bubble. It's all so easy with free money. What could possibly go wrong? You know, whether it's 0% or 2 or 3 basis points, it doesn't really make a heck of a lot of difference because it's still debt. And ordinarily, when there's huge demand for debt, the price of debt or interest rates go higher. But what we're seeing now in the global banking cartel is an agreement, more or less, that when there's more demand for debt, they simply make the parameters to borrow less stringent. They never close the debt window. So what we have is asset bubbles. We have house prices and art markets and stocks and bonds going up in price, but not as fast as the level of debt. So the wealth is completely illusory, unless, of course, this is some kind of financial anti-gravity machine, and debt never means anything for the rest of our lives, which, of course, is impossible. Every once in a while, there is a reconciliation in these markets, and you do have the asset bust, the deflation, and the occasional depression.
What should happen in a global economy? You should be rewarded for savings. That's what your parents taught you. That's what you learn in Economics 101. What's happened in the last 5-6 years? You're not rewarded for savings just by putting your cash into interest-bearing assets, because in the US, you've got negative returns on that in real terms. Why would you bother doing it? You have to look elsewhere. And this is not just true of the man and woman in the street. It's true of corporations and investment funds. You've got to look elsewhere, which is why you've seen asset bubbles appearing in housing. That's your man in the street who's able to participate in that quite easily by buying housing.
Tell you in America that you've got a healthy economy, and yet you've got 2 straight years of negative savings. They talk about wealth being built up in people's homes, and yet the foreclosure rates have never been higher. They talk about people achieving the American dream, and yet poverty rates are skyrocketing. It's all nonsense.
So, we're in a world in which speculators are making money by borrowing virtually free money from Japan or Switzerland and investing it in markets, assets, and currencies around the globe. And the man on the street is, quote-unquote, getting rich from the asset bubbles caused by all this borrowing? Asset prices have never been higher, but debt loads have never been even higher still. So how long can this laissez-faire tale last?
The carry trade revolves around being able to borrow an asset, and when you've borrowed it, you sell it, you take the proceeds from that, you invest it in another higher-yielding asset. But of course, the key consideration when going into the carry trade is that the asset that you're borrowing, you're effectively shorting it, that asset's not going to go up in value.
That's right. This carry trade scheme does have one potentially lethal problem. It's called unwinding. If the borrowed asset, in this case the yen or Swiss franc, starts to go up in value, the carry trade stops working because the cost of the original loan goes up. So everyone around the world, the bankers, the investors, and the speculators, tries to cash in their inflated stocks, bonds, currency, and real estate investments at the same time in order to pay off that low interest rate debt before it rises further in value. It is a run on the global banking system, an extremely ugly situation, and warnings about this unwinding are coming fast and furious from central bankers around the world.
Jean-Claude Trichet, the head of the European Central Bank, said in February of 2007, quote, one-way bets, and of course by this he means the carry trade, in the present circumstances would not be, it seems to us, appropriate. We want the markets to be aware of the risks they contain. Malcolm Knight, general manager of the Bank of International Settlements, the central bank of central banks, quote, there is a rising leverage in the financial system, and we have some very crowded trades in some areas of the foreign exchange markets. Mr. Knight said, speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, quote, together, these could create the potential for a very rapid repricing in financial markets. Crowded trades. Well, this is Fed speak. Crowded trades in the sense means that, according to the bankers who run the banking establishments, maybe there's not enough suckers left to make this thing really work. So he's telegraphing for those in the market to maybe get out of the market now.
Tim Lee, PI Economics.
The most famous case of yen carry trade unwinding we've had occurred in 1998 at the time of Russia, when Russia defaulted on its debt, and a large investment fund called Long-Term Capital Management basically went bankrupt, and that triggered in markets an unwinding of carry trades at that time. And the yen appreciated extremely rapidly when that happened. And some people have been concerned that, you know, we could have a repeat of that this time. But I think if I'm correct, then the size of the carry trade now is much larger than it was then.
Dr. Paul Walker.
But it's been a fairly substantial trade over the last few years. It will be. It could have global ramifications, there's no doubt about it. But it does revolve around one key question, what is the size of this trade? And we, quite frankly, we don't really know, because discerning and splitting out the genuine trade-related activities in borrowing yen and the, if you like, the speculative, because the carry trade is simply a speculative activity. Until we can split those out and get the data sets on those adequate, we don't know. But I think there are signs out there that there are worries in the global economy.
Analysts, economists, central bankers, and politicians are warning us of the dangers of an unwinding carry trade and one-way bets. So why do speculators and investors keep playing recklessly in the carry trade traffic?
People are perceiving that there isn't that much risk in doing these this borrowing in low interest rate currency. The risk of a rapid exchange rate movement occurring in a short space of time isn't very high. And I think an important factor that has contributed to that is past intervention in the currency markets by central banks, particularly, and we're talking about the yen carry trade, the intervention that the Ministry of Finance and Bank of Japan did over 2003-2004, when the yen would have risen substantially at that time, but the Bank of Japan, on the orders of the Ministry of Finance in Japan, stepped into the market and prevented the yen moving above about the 104-105 rate when it was going up.
Market intervention. That's just another word for market manipulation. These bankers are keen to keep rates low by making credit available, but they have two very devastating effects on the global economy. Number one, they are penalizing workers whose pension funds are being put at risk, and they're also making it impossible for the natural supply and demand curve to come into sync in the global markets, and debt is building up like hot magma of hot money. It may look tranquil, but once it blows, look out. Financial analysts and bankers argue that the financial carry trade must be allowed to continue because we almost enjoy the wealth and asset appreciation that it creates. But the wealth and asset creation is the result of massive yen carry trade. So their arguments are specious at best, and it's doing a lot of damage along the way to the workers, the savers, and the global economy, which is exposed to way too much risk.
Our view is simply that the central banks of the world have been putting off the day of reckoning. Their interest rate environment has enabled them to sustain this. The buying up, for example, of U.S. debt has been a key component, the key pillar globally of these imbalances that have emerged. But the longer they delay this, the more serious the day of reckoning is going to be, and it will come.
Well, here we are back on a high street in London. What did we learn from all of this? Well, what we know is that the Icelandic krona is the global financial currency of the month, the flavor of the month club. Hot money in, my guess is going to see hot money out. Thailand, remember that in the late 90s? Didn't last. And of course, what will happen to all of these brokers and bankers and private equity groups and hedge fund managers once the party's over, the punch bowl is taken away, and Iceland no longer has the hot currency of the month?
Max Kaiser reporting for Al Jazeera English TV in August 2007. The URL of his website is a bit difficult on radio, so your best bet is to Google Max Kaiser, spelt K-E-I-S-E-R. Now I'd like to read you another perspective on the financial crisis. This article was written by F. William Engdahl on October 10th. I've read you things from him before. He keeps a website at engdahl.oilgeopolitics.net and is the author of several books, including A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics from Pluto Press, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation. He has a forthcoming book, Power of Money, The Rise and Decline of the American Century. Engdahl wrote, What's clear from the behavior of European financial markets over the past 2 weeks is that the dramatic stories of financial meltdown and panic are deliberately being used by certain influential factions in and outside the EU to shape the future face of global banking in the wake of the U.S. subprime and asset-backed security, ABS, debacle. The most interesting development in recent days has been the unified and strong position of the German Chancellor, Finance Minister, Bundesbank, and coalition government, all opposing an American-style EU superfund bank bailout. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson pursues his crony capitalism to the detriment of the nation and benefit of his cronies in the financial world. It's an explosive cocktail that need not have been. Stock market falls of 7 to 10% a day make for dramatic news headlines and serve to foster a broad sense of unease bordering on panic among ordinary citizens. The events of the last 2 weeks among EU banks since the dramatic state rescues of Hypo Real Estate, Dexia, and Fortis Banks, and the announcement by the UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, Alistair Darling, of a radical shift in policy in dealing with troubled UK banks, have begun to reveal the outline of a distinctly different European response to what, in effect, is a crisis made in USA. There's serious ground to believe that U.S. Goldman Sachs ex-CEO Henry Paulson, as Treasury Secretary, is not stupid. There's also serious ground to believe that he's actually moving according to a well-thought-out long-term strategy. Events, as they're now unfolding in the EU, tend to confirm that. As one senior European banker put it to me in a private discussion, there is an all-out war going on between the United States and the EU to define the future face of European banking, close quote. In this banker's view, the ongoing attempt of Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and France's Nicolas Sarkozy to get an EU common fund with perhaps upwards of $300 billion to rescue troubled banks would de facto play directly into Paulson and the U.S. establishment's long-term strategy by, in effect, weakening the banks and repaying U.S.-originated asset-backed securities held by EU banks, using panic to centralize power. As I document in my forthcoming book, Power of Money, The Rise and Decline of the American Century, in every major U.S. financial panic, since at least the Panic of 1835, the titans of Wall Street, most especially until 1929, the House of J.P. Morgan, have deliberately triggered bank panics behind the scenes in order to consolidate their grip on U.S. banking. The private banks used the panics to control Washington policy, including the exact definition of the private ownership of the new Federal Reserve in 1913, and to consolidate their control over industry such as U.S. Steel, Caterpillar, Westinghouse, and the like. They are, in short, old hands at such financial warfare to increase their power. Now, they must do something similar on a global scale to be able to continue to dominate global finance, the heart of the power of the American century. That process of using panics to centralize their private power created an extremely powerful concentration of financial and economic power in a few private hands. The same hands which created the influential U.S. foreign policy think tank, the New York Council on Foreign Relations in 1919, to guide the ascent of the American century, as Time founder Henry Luce called it in a pivotal 1941 essay. It's becoming increasingly obvious that people like Henry Paulson, who, by the way, was one of the most aggressive practitioners of the ABS revolution on Wall Street before becoming Treasury Secretary, are operating on motives beyond their over-proportional sense of greed. Paulson's own background is interesting in that context. Back in the early 1970s, Paulson started his career working for a rather notorious man named John Ehrlichman, Nixon's ruthless advisor who created the Plumbers Unit during the Watergate era to silence opponents of the president and was left by Nixon to twist in the wind for it in prison. Paulson seems to have learned from his White House mentor. As co-chairman of Goldman Sachs, according to a New York Times account, in 1998 he forced out his co-chairman, John Corzine, in what amounted to a coup, according to the Times. Paulson and his friends at Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase had a strategy that is becoming clear, as did the godfather of asset-backed securitization and deregulated banking, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, as I have detailed in my earlier series here, Financial Tsunami, Parts 1 through 5. Knowing that at a certain juncture, the pyramid of trillions of dollars of dubious subprime and other high-risk home mortgage-based securities would come falling down, they apparently determined to spread the so-called toxic waste ABS securities as globally as possible in order to seduce the big global banks of the world, most especially of the EU, into their honey trap. They had help. In recent testimony under oath at the AIG bailout oversight hearing, Eric DiNallo, the superintendent of the New York Insurance Department, testified that funding cutbacks in recent years directed by the Bush-Cheney administration had reduced the responsible department that should regulate or watch over the $80 trillion in asset-backed securities, which included the toxic subprime and Alt-A mortgage securities and much more. The Bush administration took the staff of more than 100 people down to one. Yes, that was not a typo. One, as in uno. Was that just ideological budget-cutting fervor, or was it deliberate? Was the former Goldman Sachs man, the man who convinced the president to hire Paulson, Bush's former director of the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, Joshua Bolton, now the president's chief of staff responsible for ensuring that there was no effective government oversight on the exploding securitization of mortgage assets? These are perhaps some questions which the good congressman ought to be asking people like Henry Paulson and Josh Bolton, and not such red herring questions as how large Richard Fuld's bonus pay at Lehman was. Are Mr. Bolton's fingerprints on the corpse here? And why is no one questioning the role of Paulson as CEO of Goldman Sachs, then the most aggressive promoter of exotic and other asset-backed securitization products on Wall Street? It would now appear that the Paulson strategy was to use a crisis that was pre-programmed and predictable as far back as 2003 when Josh Bolton became the head of OMB. When it exploded, to panic the more conservative European Union governments into rushing to the rescue of U.S. toxic waste assets. Were that to have happened, it would, in the process, destroy what was left of sound EU banking and financial institutions, bringing the world one step closer to a global money market controlled by Paulson's cronies, U.S.-style crony capitalism. Crony capitalism is certainly appropriate here. Paulson's predecessor at Goldman Sachs and at the Treasury, Robert Rubin, liked to accuse the Asian bankers of Thailand, Indonesia, and other lands hit with the speculative attacks of U.S.-financed hedge funds in 1997 of crony capitalism, leaving the impression the crisis was homegrown in Asia and not the result of a deliberate, executed attack by U.S.-financed financial institutions to eliminate the Asia Tiger model, among other goals, and turn Asia into the funder of U.S. debt. Interesting to note is that Rubin is now a director of Citigroup, obviously one of Paulson's crony bank survivors, and the bank which to date has had to write off the largest sum in toxic waste securitized assets. If the allegation of pre-planned panic a la the panic of 1907 is accurate, and that is a big if, then the plan worked up to a point. The point came over the weekend of October 3rd, coincidentally the national unification holiday of Germany. And I'm reading from Behind the Panic, Financial Warfare Over the Future of Global Bank Power by F. William Engdahl. Continuing, Germany breaks with U.S. model. In closed-door talks well into the evening of Sunday, October 5th, Alex Weber, the hard-nosed head of the Bundesbank, BaFin head Jochen Sanyo, and representatives of the Berlin coalition government of Chancellor Merkel came up with a rescue package for Hypo Real Estate of a nominal 50 billion euros. However, behind the dramatic headline number, as Weber pointed out in a September 29th letter to Finance Minister Peer Steinbrück that has been made public, not only did the private German banks have to come up with 60% of that figure, the state with 40%, but also, given the careful manner in which the government, in cooperation with the Bundesbank and BaFin, structured the rescue credit agreement, the maximum possible loss in a worst-case scenario to the state bank would be limited to 5.7 billion euros, not 30 billion, as many believed. It's still real money, but not the blank check for 700 billion that a U.S. Congress under duress and a few days of falling stock market prices agreed to give to Paulson. The swift action by Finance Minister Steinbrück to fire the head of HRE, that's Hypo Real Estate, in stark contrast to Wall Street, where the same criminal fraudsters remain at their desks reaping huge bonuses, indicates as well a different approach. But that does not cut to the heart of the issue. The situation of HRE arose, as noted previously, from excesses in a wholly owned daughter bank of HRE subsidiary DEPFA in Ireland, an EU country known for its liberal loose regulation and low tax regime, a British policy shift. In the UK, after the costly and foolish bailout of Northern Rock earlier in the year, the government of Prime Minister Gordon Brown has just announced a dramatic change in policy in the direction of Germany's position. Britain's banks will get an unprecedented £50 billion, 64 billion euro, government lifeline and emergency loans from the Bank of England. The government will buy preference shares from Royal Bank of Scotland Group, Barclays, and at least six other banks, and provide about £250 billion of loan guarantees to refinance debt, the Treasury said. The Bank of England will make at least £200 billion available. The plan doesn't specify how much each bank will get. That means the UK government will at least partially nationalize its most important international banks, rather than buy their bad loans as under the unworkable Paulson plan. Under such an approach, once the crisis abates and business returns to more normal conditions, the government can sell the state shares back to a healthy bank at perhaps a nice profit to the Treasury. The Brown government has apparently realized that the blanket guarantees it gave to Northern Rock and Bradford and Bingley merely opened the floodgates of government costs without changing the problem. The new nationalization policy is a dramatic contrast to the Paulson ideological, quote, free market approach of buying worthless bonds held by the select banks Paulson chooses to save, rather than recapitalize those banks to allow them to continue to function. The battle lines drawn. What has emerged are the outlines of two opposite approaches to the unfolding crisis. The Paulson plan is now clearly part of a project to create three colossal global financial giants: Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, and of course Paulson's own Goldman Sachs. Now conveniently enough, a bank. Having successfully used fear and panic to wrestle a $700 billion bailout from the U.S. taxpayers, now the big three will try to use their unprecedented muscle to ravage European banks in the years ahead. So as long as the world's largest financial credit rating agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's, are untouched by the scandals and congressional hearings, The reorganized U.S. financial power of Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan Chase could potentially regroup and advance their global agenda over the coming several years, walking over the ashes of a bankrupt American economy made bankrupt by their follies. By agreeing on a strategy of nationalizing what EU finance ministers deem are EU banks too systemically strategic to fall, while guaranteeing bank deposits, the largest EU governments, Germany and the UK, in contrast to the US, have opted for what will in the longer run allow European banking giants to withstand the anticipated financial attacks from the likes of Goldman or Citigroup. The dramatic sell-off of stocks across European bourses and across Asia is in reality a secondary and far less critical issue. According to market reports, the sell-off is being driven mainly by U.S. hedge funds desperate to raise cash as they realize the U.S. economy is going into economic depression, that they are exposed, and that the Paulson plan does nothing to address that. A functioning, solvent banking and interbank system is far more the strategic issue. The ABS debacle was made in New York. Nonetheless, its effects have to be isolated and viable EU banks defended in the public interest, not just the interest of Paulson's banking cronies as in the U.S. Unregulated offshore vehicles such as hedge funds, unregulated banking, unregulated insurance all went into building the $80 trillion ABS tsunami, as I have called it. Certain more conservative EU hands are not about to buy the remedy being offered by Washington. The coordinated interest rate cut by the ECB and other European central banks, while grabbing headlines, in effect do little to address the real problem. Banks fear to lend to each other until their solvency is assured. By initiating state partial nationalizations across the EU and rejecting the Berlusconi-Sarkozy bailout scheme, the governments of the EU, interestingly enough, this time led by the Germans, are laying a more sound foundation to emerge from the crisis. Stay tuned, it's far from over. This is a fight for the survival of the American century, which has been built since 1939 on the twin pillars of financial dominance and American military dominance, full spectrum dominance. Asian banks, badly burned by Wall Street's manipulated 1997-98 Asia crisis, are apparently very little exposed to the U.S. problem. European banks are exposed in different ways, but none so serious as in the U.S. banking world. And I was reading Behind the Panic, Financial Warfare Over the Future of Global Bank Power by F. William Engdahl. His website, where the other articles he's referred to can be read, is engdahl.oilgeopolitics.net. Engdahl is engdahl.oilgeopolitics.net. That article published October 10th, 2008. And finally, the conclusion of Blaming the Victim, Chapter 10 of Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. By 2004, one out of every 138 U.S. residents was in jail. About 5 million Americans are arrested every year, and one in every five Americans has a criminal record. The victims of the penal system are the most vulnerable members of the working class, as the Reverend Jesse Jackson explains, quote, 65% of all prisoners are high school dropouts, 70% are functionally illiterate, and 63% recidivate. We are often tempted to think of China as an oppressive country, but we incarcerate 500,000 more people in this country, despite the fact that we have less than one-fourth the population of China. We lock up our poor, our uneducated, our unruly, our unstable, our addicted, where other countries provide treatment, mental hospitals, and care. Close quote. Mass incarceration is socially harmful. Like the workhouses of the 19th century, modern prisons are giant incubators for disease, confining sick people in crowded quarters with poor food and little or no medical care. Imprisoned addicts are denied clean drugs and clean needles, and all prisoners are denied condoms. As a result, the number of prisoners with HIV is 10 times the rate in the general population. Hepatitis C, an often lethal liver disease spread by blood exchange, infects an estimated 41% of inmates in California prisons, compared to less than 2% of the population at large. The law enforcement approach to drug use is directly responsible for the soaring rates of HIV/AIDS in America. Every year, hundreds of thousands of released prisoners take their diseases out of prison with them, endangering family, friends, and coworkers. In the early 1990s, a deadly strain of tuberculosis swept through the New York prison system, killing 35 prisoners and infecting more than 1,000 people outside. The employer's offensive has transformed the 1960s dream of liberation into a nightmare of persecution, incarceration, and disease. With only 5% of the world's population, the United States holds more than 25% of the world's prisoners. The Twin Towers Correctional Facility in Los Angeles is the biggest jail on the planet. The ruling class undoubtedly feels safer. However, the prison system does not prevent violence. It strengthens the greatest source of violence, the system itself. Martin Luther King Jr. acknowledged this when he said, "I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government." Blaming blacks. Inequality in America is not just a matter of class. Whole sections of the population are treated like second-class citizens solely because of their skin color. The ruling class needs to explain the oppression of black people in a way that does not implicate the system. The solution is blame the victim, racism. In 1965, a U.S. government report titled "The Negro Family, A Case for National Action," blamed the depressed condition of blacks on their weak family structure. The report claimed that unless this damage is repaired, all the effort to end discrimination and poverty and injustice will come to little. Instead of pointing out that weak family structure is a result of racism and poverty, influential publications like Life, Look, and the New York Times supported the attack on anti-poverty programs. William Ryan wrote "Blaming the Victim" to protest the resurgence of ideas about hereditary defects in blacks, the poor, and working people in general. In 1967, a trio of Harvard professors claimed that the urban rebellions that were rocking American cities could not be attributed to poor social conditions because most people who shared those conditions did not participate in the uprisings. Therefore, there must be something peculiar about those who rebelled, and that peculiarity should be studied. They showed no interest in why more people did not rebel against injustice. Under capitalism, submission is not considered to be a social problem. The Department of Justice rushed to fund the professor's quest to identify a violence gene and chemical imbalances that could be corrected by psychiatric drugs and brain surgery. One prisoner was recommended for psychosurgery because he was disrespectful, led a work strike, read revolutionary material, and refused to stop teaching karate and judo to his fellow inmates. In 1972, the National Institute for Mental Health decided to study the biological roots of violence in black youth. A national opposition movement closed down this project 2 years later. However, a number of states launched their own programs. California planned several centers for the study of the reduction of violence that would conduct genetic research and do brain surgery. Activists made sure they never opened. As Peter and Ginger Bregan point out, The arguments used to be that blacks were docile and hence biologically predisposed to slavery. Now in a few generations, they're supposed to be genetically predisposed to rebellion. This is not science. This is the use of psychiatry and science in the interest of social policy. Close quote. Washington was not deterred. In 1993, the National Research Council recommended mass psychiatric screening of black children as young as 4 months old to identify those who might be violence prone so they could be treated with medications that reduce violent behavior. The insistence that black equals criminal has long been used to persecute and incarcerate black people. White people form 70% of the U.S. population and commit the majority of interpersonal crimes, so that the typical American criminal is white. However, only 35% of the prison population is white. Black and Hispanic people fill the nation's prisons, not because skin color is genetically linked with criminality, but because the penal system has a history of targeting people of color, from the black codes of the early 1800s through Jim Crow segregation to the war on drugs. Continuing efforts to paint all blacks as criminals have reversed the gains of the civil rights movement and driven a wedge of fear between black and white populations. Modern racial profiling is a form of blaming the victim that goes something like this. Most people in prison are black. Therefore, blacks are more likely to be criminals. Therefore, the penal system is justified in targeting black people. Racial profiling has made it a crime to drive while black. Every day, thousands of black drivers are pulled over by police, searched, and abused simply because of their skin color. According to the Justice Department, police are more than twice as likely to search vehicles driven by blacks, even though whites are more than twice as likely to be found with illegal items. A report for the New Jersey State Police found that, quote, African Americans and Latinos account for 78% of those searched, yet troops found evidence of drugs in the searches of whites 25% of the time, of blacks 13% of the time, and of Latinos only 5% of the time, close quote. A 1998 national survey found that affluent, educated whites are more likely to be drug users and drug addicts. Nevertheless, police looking for illegal drug activity target blacks and black neighborhoods. Blacks are more likely than whites to be arrested, convicted, and sent to prison. Anti-drug laws victimize the poor, who are also more likely to be black. Probation is the only penalty for possessing 5 grams of expensive powdered cocaine. In contrast, possessing 5 grams of cheaper crack cocaine carries a mandatory 5-year prison sentence. Because of such systemic racism, 90% of the people in prison for drug possession are black. In 1980, there were 3 times as many black men in college as there were in prison. By 2000, there were nearly 200,000 more black men in prison than there were in college. On any given day, nearly 1 in 3 young black men in America is in prison, on probation, or on parole. In some places, like Baltimore, Maryland, and Washington, D.C., more than half of the black male population is under the thumb of the judicial system. More victim blaming. The demand for greater productivity leads to more workplace accidents, injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. Instead of taking responsibility for these problems, employers blame workers for being careless and accident prone. In 1966, the term accident-prone personality was listed as a psychiatric diagnosis in the American Handbook of Psychiatry. Blaming the worker is more cost-effective than providing a safe workplace. Consider the following example. 33-year-old lineman Brent Churchill died when he reached for a 7,200-volt cable with his bare hands. His boss blamed Churchill's death on his failure to put on insulating gloves. The story behind the story was that the company had downsized the lineman department and was caught shorthanded during a major storm. Instead of calling back the laid-off workers, management forced the existing crews to work overtime. For 55 of the 60 hours before he died, Churchill was climbing up and down 30-foot poles in freezing weather. He was neither careless nor lazy. He was overworked and exhausted. Human beings are not machines. It is normal for people to become absent-minded and distracted by stress, fatigue, family problems, and other worries. At times, everyone misunderstands, misinterprets, and misreads. A workplace that functions safely only when no one ever makes a mistake is a dangerous workplace. A safe workplace protects workers when they make inevitable human errors. Medicine under capitalism has a strong element of victim blaming. The assumption that people who become sick must have done something wrong or be defective in some way. The protest movements of the 1960s challenged this view, emphasizing social conditions as a cause of poor health and demanding a national healthcare system. To counter this movement, the Rockefeller Foundation sponsored a conference in 1975 to set a new direction for health policy that would cut medical costs, crush the expectation that medical care should be a right, and divert attention from the social causes of disease. All three goals could be accomplished by blaming the victim. Speakers at the conference condemned, quote, irresponsible individuals who indulge in sickness-promoting behaviors and burden responsible people with excess taxes and higher medical insurance premiums. Following this conference, the Rockefeller Group wrote a series of policy papers promoting individual responsibility for health. In 1979, Healthy People, the Surgeon General's Report on Health Promotion and Disease Prevention, blamed personal excesses for the lion's share of runaway health costs. Subsequent government health promotion campaigns instructed the public to eat right, get active, stop smoking, drink responsibly, say no to drugs, abstain from sex, work safely, etc. The nation's medical journals fell in line with the new policy. The nation's medical journals fell in line with the new policy, treating health as an individual responsibility and sickness as a personal failure. One journal article blamed the lead poisoning of poor children on the permissive socialization of oral behavior. Instead of demanding that landlords remove lead-based paint from low-income apartments, parents were held responsible for letting children put their hands in their mouths after touching objects coated with lead dust. Blame the victim articles increased as more research funding was dedicated to study how poor people make themselves sick. The campaign to blame the sick found an ally in the self-help movements of the 1970s. People practicing holistic health care rejected the use of medicines and vaccines. Self-care was promoted as the way to free oneself from reliance on doctors and potentially harmful medical treatments. The New Age emphasis on personal responsibility meshed with the employer's efforts to dismantle state-funded medical care. While social activists fought for more access to the medical system, self-help advocates like Ivan Illich argued that less access would be more beneficial. When it comes to epidemics like cancer, victim blaming is rampant. While industries flood the environment with cancer-causing chemicals and the state dismantles environmental protections, cancer research concentrates on modifying individual behaviors, drinking, smoking, nutrition, and developing individual treatments. Cancer prevention is dismissed as unrealistic. According to the website of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, quote, breast cancer cannot be prevented. However, studies show that early detection of breast cancer saves lives, close quote. Preventing cancer would require removing carcinogens from production, cleaning up toxic waste dumps, closing down the nuclear power industry, and prohibiting the military from using chemical and radioactive weapons. In other words, cancer prevention is impossible under capitalism. With cancer prevention blocked at the social level, experts concentrate on advising individuals what they should and should not do to prevent cancer. Their recommendations are as useful as duck and cover exercises during the Cold War, where school children were instructed to duck under their desks and cover their heads in case of a nuclear attack. Personal protective measures don't prevent cancer. They blame people for getting cancer by focusing on individual behavior. Even personality can be targeted. Some experts warn that the risk of cancer increases for people who repress their emotions and ignore their needs. Ironically, the same behaviors that employers demand of workers, especially women. In fact, the cancer-prone personality is a myth. Scientific studies on two continents found absolutely no connection between personality type and susceptibility to cancer. Nevertheless, the myth endures because it offers false hope to people who want to avoid cancer, makes money for those who sell hope, and takes pressure off the primary source of cancer, the capitalist system. It would be wonderful if people could be healthy simply by making the right choices. However, most illnesses arise from social conditions, overwork, unemployment, workplace hazards, excess stress, inadequate housing, poverty and malnutrition, environmental toxins, and lack of medical care. As long as people live in health-damaging conditions, it is impossible to distinguish how much the individual contributes and how much society contributes to any particular problem. Do individuals have any responsibility for their health? People should be held responsible only for what they control. They cannot be held responsible for what they do not control. Capitalism turns this principle upside down. Those with the most power take no responsibility for social problems. Those with the least power get all the blame. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, Henry Ford blamed lazy workers for high unemployment. The average man won't really do a day's work unless he is caught and cannot get out of it. There's plenty of work to do if people would do it, close quote. A week later, he laid off 75,000 auto workers. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. An unjust world. The pyramid-shaped socioeconomic hierarchy and the power of the elite at the top of it will be secure as long as those at the lower levels blame one another for their lack of access to jobs with greater decision-making power, and as long as they fail to question the system that makes the decision-making power scarce in the first place by holding so much of it at the top. Jeff Schmidt. We want to think we live in a just world where people reap what they sow, where what goes around comes around, and where those who play by the rules are rewarded. Belief in a just world is shaken by tragedy and secured by blaming the victim. When Andrea Yates killed her children in a psychotic state, I overheard someone say, "She shouldn't have had so many children if she couldn't take care of them." Such blaming comments shield people from thinking about the desperate conditions that could drive a mother, possibly any mother, to kill her children. It is more comforting to condemn Yates than to think about how trapped she was and how trapped we are. People blame themselves for the problems in their lives because, in a strange way, self-blame offers the illusion of control. I could have made something of myself if only I had dot, dot, dot. Blaming implies responsibility, that the person had the power to make things right and just messed up. People would rather blame themselves than think that forces beyond their control could pull the rug out from under them no matter what they do. If there is no justice in society, if people can be harmed through no fault of their own, then we are powerless to protect ourselves and our loved ones. Powerlessness is so frightening that people dissociate from reality and believe what they want to believe. It is more comforting to believe that misfortune visits only those who make bad decisions, so that one can be safe by making good decisions. In reality, the world is a dangerous place because the people in charge protect themselves at the expense of everyone else. The struggles of the 1960s exposed capitalism as a sick system. And masses of people began to see that they were in the same boat. To take back control, the ruling class had to change that perception. Hollywood did its part, producing films like Easy Rider and Up in Smoke that portrayed the 1960s as a continuous orgy of drugs, sex, and rock and roll. If you remember the 1960s, then you weren't there. The fact that millions of people had organized to change the world was belittled and then erased from public memory. When the social matrix in which we are embedded is invisible, it is easier to blame individuals for social problems and for individuals to blame themselves and each other. Ordinary people do not benefit from victim blaming. By 2001, the annual cost of police, courts, and prisons had reached $267 billion, up from $36 billion in 1982. This money was taken from social programs known to reduce crime: education, job training, recreational programs, better housing, and treatment for mental illness and drug addiction. Persecuting poor people doesn't make society safer. It results in more desperation and less public safety. Criminalizing drug use leads to more drug use and more drug-related crimes. Illegal drugs are so expensive that poor addicts must sell them to pay for their own supply. Others resort to theft and prostitution. One study of a crackdown on illegal drug use found that as police cleared one area, drug-related activity moved into new areas. A 1994 study funded by the White House recommended that funds be transferred from law enforcement to drug treatment programs because treatment is 7 times more cost-effective than domestic drug enforcement in reducing cocaine use and 15 times more cost-effective in reducing the social costs of crime and lost productivity, close quote. The Clinton administration rejected this advice because the war on drugs is not about stopping drug use. Its purpose is to impose social control. That same year, President Clinton ended educational grants for prisoners, even though education is the single most important factor in whether a released prisoner returns to jail. Prisons are big business. The public foots the bill, and private corporations reap the profits, not only from government contracts, but also from convict labor. In 1979, Congress created the Prison Industry Enhancement Certification Program that allows businesses to employ inmates and sell prisoner-made goods. The prison labor system is modern legal slavery. Prisoners are compliant, disposable labor with no legal rights. Inmate workers earn just pennies an hour, so the profits are huge, billions of dollars every year. More prisoners and longer sentences mean even more profit. At the beginning of the 21st century, class inequality has never been greater. The race to incarcerate reflects the determination of the capitalist class to continue squeezing the working class and to prevent them from rebelling against this injustice. Criminalizing drug use allows the state to intervene in the daily activities of the working class. More cops, more prisons, and harsher laws give the ruling class more power to dominate society. Blaming the most exploited and oppressed for social problems is like blaming the canaries in the mine who keeled over when toxic gas levels rise. The canaries warn the miners that their lives are in danger. The poor and the persecuted are like society's canaries. Their suffering warns everyone else that they are next. We can shoot the messenger by blaming the victim, or we can heed the message. Portraying victims as villains only works when the majority is divided. The next chapter explains how the capitalist class divides in order to rule. Summary: feudalism attributed class inequality to God's will. Capitalism attributes class inequality to the superiority of the few and the defectiveness of the many. Blaming the victim protects the system. As long as ordinary people blame themselves and each other for the problems that are created by the ruling class, there will be more problems and more victims. And I've been reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. That, the conclusion of Chapter 10, blaming the victim. We'll continue with a new chapter next week. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. If you have questions and comments, please email them to me at the email link at the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where MP3 downloads of this and all previous episodes are also available. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.